welcome back to the Rest of Culture podcast. I'm your host, Frank Ebersold. And if you've had anything to do with the 80s, you'll know exactly where that song is coming from. And I'll tell you a little bit more about why I'm playing it later in the podcast. You'll get all the details. But I do want to welcome you back, and we've had a lot going on this week. We've had some updates with the Russian investigation and the Mueller investigation that I'd like to update everybody with. And you know, it's kind of funny, isn't it? We haven't heard Trump refer to Steve Bannon as old sloppy Steve. What happened to that? One week it's sloppy Steve Bannon, and then it just ends. Well, old sloppy Steve Bannon, he kind of pulled a delay tactic when he said that he wouldn't answer any questions on Tuesday that dealt with his transition or tenure in the White House. And at some points during Bannon's 6 hours of closed-door testimony, his attorney took breaks to confer via telephone with the White House counsel's office to clarify what questions could be answered, and they came back with the same guidance every time. Bannon couldn't discuss any activities related to the transition or his tenure in the White House. And one source that's familiar with the proceedings said all shots were being called by the White House. Now, ask yourself this. Why would sloppy Steve be told not to answer any questions by the White House? He did answer some, but the ones that were dealing with his time during the transition and afterwards. Why would he be told not to answer any questions on those two things by the White House? Why? And at the same time, be told that they were not invoking executive privilege. The White House did not invoke executive privilege, but they told him not to answer those questions. It's a bit of a riddle. And I think the answer is this, my friends. As much as Trump derided Sloppy Steve for his comments in the Fire and Fury book, he stopped all of a sudden, like I said, and when he realized that Sloppy Steve was going to be testifying before the House Intelligence Committee, It just stopped. And it's kind of funny how that really shut Trump down. When he realized that Sloppy Steve was going to be testifying, it all stopped. And I think the reason for all of this is that Trump finally realized that Sloppy Steve just got kicked out of his orbit by himself, which obviously means that Trump, number one, doesn't know what Sloppy Steve will say, and two, Trump needs time so both he and Sloppy Steve can get their stories straight. They got to figure this out. He doesn't want them sitting down all of a sudden and discussing things that he has no control over. He'd like to have a little bit of control, if you haven't noticed. It's one thing Donald Trump likes is control. And did you also notice that Sloppy Steve's lawyer, Michael Burke, is also representing one of Trump's lawyers, Don McGahn? Well, I can tell you, I think Trump and Sloppy Steve are going to be back together faster than Trump can order more White House meatloaf. Just wait and see. Bannon's delay is all a ploy to gain more time and bring Sloppy Steve back into the Trump orbit. And they really do have time to do this, saying that Trump has yet to agree on a time to sit down with Mueller for an interview. But with this Russian investigation, there is a little bit more, and my show notes kind of indicate an article by Business Insider, by a writer named Natasha Bertrand, who from time to time you see on MSNBC, does a great job at everything she does with this, and she's has a total handle on what's going on with this Russian investigation. So in that article, click on that, and you can read some of the details that I'm going to share with you right now. But just yesterday, on Thursday, January 18th, the House Intelligence Committee voted to release their version of the Glenn Simpson Fusion GPS testimony. And as you recall, last week, Dianne Feinstein released the Senate Judiciary's testimony from Glenn Simpson. And according to this article from Business Insider, rather than hone in on the nature of Simpson's relationship with Christopher Steele, the former British intelligence officer that was hired by Fusion to research Trump's Russia ties, Schiff and his Democratic colleagues asked Simpson pointed questions about Russian money laundering, Russian organized crime, and whether Trump could be susceptible to Russian blackmail. And here are just a few things, folks, that were uncovered in the House Intelligence Committee's interview with Glenn Simpson. There's 3 points. I'd like to boil it down at this time to those 3 points. And there was just so much that's in there. There's going to be more coming out of that as we discover more of it. But it certainly gives the Mueller investigation a lot to look into. No wonder his investigation is taking the amount of time that it is. It's not easy following the shell companies and following the money and unraveling this rat's nest of stuff that's that was disclosed in this Glenn Simpson testimony. Well, here are the 3 things. The first one is the FBI is investigating whether top Russian banker Alexander Torshin, who has close ties with the Kremlin, sent money to the NRA to help President Trump win the election. Well, that would be an interesting development, wouldn't it? And everybody recalls the Citizens United situation that was passed in 2010 that allows people to not disclose, you know, who the donors are and where the money's coming from. And when you've got that going on, stuff like this can happen, right? And according to Axios, why this matters is the NRA spent $30 million to support Trump in 2016. And that's triple what they spent on fellow Republican Mitt Romney back in 2012. And Axios says that the sources of those donations were not disclosed. Thank you, Citizens United. And 2 people have told McClatchy, news service, that the gun lobby's actual election spend for Trump might have been closer to $70 million. $70 million, folks. That's a lot of money. And it kind of leads to the question, exactly how much money did Russia or Russians spend to help elect Donald Trump? Now, this Russian banker, Alexander Torshin, is also a lifetime NRA member who has been described as a godfather in Russian organized crime, the syndicate that's known as Taganskaya. Well, the second point that we'd like to make is that we also discovered that a man named Rybolovlev, and again, my pronunciation of these Russian names is just abysmal. I realize that, but kind of bear with me. Rybolovlev. This fellow is a Russian multi-billionaire who was an early investor in one of the world's most lucrative fertilizer companies. Fertilizer companies, can you believe that? And this goes back to a story that I discussed in previous episodes where this fellow bought a Palm Beach property from Donald Trump for $95 million back in 2008. And that was 2 years after Trump put it on the market for $125 million. And Trump had purchased the property for $41 million back in 2004. And I think in the previous episode, I shared details with you. The decoration in there was sort of, I would call it haphazard in this mansion. You know, there's pictures online. You can check it out. It just didn't have any class, which, I mean, surprise. We're talking Donald Trump here. And that's the story where I said that one of the realtors was walking around with Donald Trump, and when he turned his back and walked away, he scratched some of the gold off of one of the bathroom fixtures. It wasn't even gold-plated, it was gold-painted, for God's sakes. Well, Rybolovlev, he never lived in this mansion, and he's since torn it down, but an advisor, Sergey Chernitsyn, told Business Insider last year that there was every prospect that this investment will turn out to be profitable. And Rybolovlev's cash infusion into Trump's bank account with that house sale is believed to be the most expensive, and it's believed to be the most expensive home sale, by the way, in U.S. history. But according to PolitiFact, in 2008, when this happened, that was the year that Donald Trump Entertainment Resorts missed a $53.1 million bond interest payment, and they later filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, protection to reorganize. So this money came at a very, very critical time. And it's kind of interesting that it came from a Russian. So that's something, that's what we know. And to me, it doesn't, obviously, it smells bad. I mean, it stinks, right? I mean, get the spray. I mean, it stinks. But this is undoubtedly something that Mueller is looking into for sure. And again, it takes time to look into this stuff, folks. I mean, this is not easy. And the third point that I'd like to make in this testimony that came from Glenn Simpson said that Trump's golf courses in Scotland and Ireland were also very concerning because financial statements obtained by Fusion showed enormous amounts of capital flowing into these projects from unknown sources. Enormous amounts of capital. At least on paper, it says it's from the Trump Organization, Glenn Simpson said, but it's hundreds of millions of dollars, he said. And I further quote Glenn Simpson here. He says, and these golf courses are just, you know, they're sinks. They don't actually make any money. It just keeps getting more interesting. And in that room, one of the people that was asking Glenn Simpson questions was GOP Representative Congressman Tom Rooney. And he said that the story about Trump financing Dunebeg, which is the name of the resort in Ireland, through money that we can't really trace, but has the sort of fingerprints of Russian mobsters, he called it fascinating. Fascinating. I would call it disqualifying. And he goes later on to say that if we knew that Donald Trump was working with the Russian mafia to fund Dunebeg in Ireland, then there's no way he could be president. So, I mean, that's why it's so fascinating. Fascinating, he calls it. There's no way he could be president. That's fascinating. Well, point number four that I'd like to make here. Other concerning patterns, Simpson said, including fast turnover deals and deals where there seem to have been efforts to disguise the identity of the buyer. And specifically, Glenn Simpson said, a project in Panama, the one in Toronto, those both got a lot of fraud associated with them, a lot of fraud allegations, a lot of activity that I would say smacks of fraud, and a lot of Russian mafia figures listed as buyers who may or may not have actually put money into it. And that's kind of an interesting point. A lot of Russian mafia figures listed as buyers who may or may not have actually put money into it. And one of the things that Rachel Maddow said in her show yesterday, last night, was that in certain times of Trump's business in real estate, certain times, it was hard for him to get financing, and one of the ways that he would get financing is by selling, or at least saying that he sold a lot of units in a building. That way he could show that to a bank who would later say, okay, we will now step in and finance this project. So when I hear Glenn Simpson say that there were a lot of Russia mafia figures that were listed as buyers who may or may not have actually put money into it, that's what I'm thinking of. Might have happened. And it's interesting stuff. And, you know, folks, we've heard so many times from Donald Trump here that he has no Russian connections. And if half of this Glenn Simpson testimony proves to be true, I have to wonder, would Donald Trump resign as a result of these apparent lies? I mean, we've heard so many times that he has no Russian connections. Would this be enough to force him to resign? And maybe this explains a lot of why Trump seems crazy and acts crazy. I mean, how can you keep all this in your head, yet tell everyone something completely different? I just don't get it. This might explain his craziness. And folks, I have to say, the end of his presidency would be clearly his fault, a result of self-implosion, and yet the media and every intelligence agency besides Russia will be portrayed as an enemy. In fact, we've seen this happen already. It's never his fault, is it? When something happens to Donald, he never apologizes. like the shithole comments. He denies it because he doesn't want to apologize for it. Doesn't want to apologize. It's never his fault. Well, at some point, I think that this information, and like I said, if just half of it is true, he's going to have to step forward and take some responsibility for it. Well, later last week, I think it was Wednesday, did you see the fake news awards? I mean, come on. Donald Trump gave the broadcaster CNN four of its fake news awards on Wednesday as he used the gimmick to escalate his attacks on the media. And, you know, folks, here's the deal. It's always drama with Trump, isn't it? It's always some sort of drama. If he had just simply said, just watch Fox News, just watch Fox News, it would have been far easier than the time and drama of the fake news awards. That's all he wants you to do. Just listen to his, read his Twitter feed and watch Fox News. Endless. Well, did you hear Rush Limbaugh? He's endlessly pandering to Trump. I know. You know this. And on Wednesday, Rush Limbaugh said this. Make a note. Here we are, January 17th, 2018. Let's see how long it takes before Trumpism becomes a decade or the year, whatever, of greed and selfishness. Well, you got to be kidding me here. I mean, too late, Rush. It's actually Trump's life. It's his life. And Rush, you must have missed the interview with Eric Trump where he said his father only sees green. Only sees green. I mean, Trumpism becomes a decade? It's been his life. It's been his life. Well, there's another article that I don't know if you've seen it with all this news kind of going around, but Trump Hotels refuses to leave Panama despite the vote to oust the company. Have you seen that article? And this is by Newsweek, and there's a link on my show notes that you can use to check this out and read through it in a little bit more detail. But yes, folks, this is the same building in Panama that was mentioned in Glenn Simpson's house testimony that I was just talking about. This is that Panamanian hotel. And evidently, there's an attempt to try to strip President Donald Trump's name from a hotel building in Panama, and it's turned bitter. According to Newsweek, with the U.S. leader's hotel company refusing to leave the Central American country without a fight, like a damn barnacle. You just can't get that barnacle out of the country, can you? And owners of the Trump International Hotel in Panama City, which is also the country's capital, are reportedly fighting. They're fighting, folks, to have the name of the building changed and oust the president's hotel management company, which is known as Trump Hotels. However, there's two people in this article that are familiar with the matter, and they've told the Associated Press that Trump staff ran off. They ran off a team of Marriott executives that were invited last month to visit the property as a prospective new hotel operator. Would have loved to have seen that. And owners of the Trump International Hotel in Panama City are reportedly fighting to have the name of the building changed and oust the president's hotel management company. And the head of Trump Hotels, Eric Danziger, also called Marriott's CEO to complain about the visit that they made to the hotel. And this is what's being told to the Associated Press. And evidently what's going on here, the Owners Association has already stripped the president's name from its title and in all communications and the website and printed material. And the company cited complaints over alleged mismanagement, a claim the organization, obviously Trump Hotels, refuted. Not only do we have a valid, binding, and enforceable long-term management agreement, but any suggestion that the hotel is not performing up to expectations is belied by the actual facts, the Trump organization said in November. And in November of last year, it's also emerged that the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump, who had been tasked with overseeing the international hotel project, had enlisted an accused Brazilian fraudster. This fraudster had connections to drug money, launderers, and Russian criminals as the hotel's top broker. So she evidently put this guy in charge of selling the building, which he did. Lots of bad connections there. Drug money, launderers, and Russian criminals. Well, the Trump Organization distanced itself from the businessman. His name is Alexander Ventura Nogueira, saying that it was never aware of his involvement. Don't know who he is. Never seen the guy. But I got to tell you here, folks, there's an article by NBC News, and I've got a link in my show notes, and you can see a picture of Alexandra Ventura Nogueira standing right next to the president, smiling at Mar-a-Lago, having such a great time. Lots of bubbly going around. Good drinks, good times. But yet, they say that they've never met him and they were unaware of his involvement. Isn't that funny? Sounds like a little bit of a fib, doesn't it? And folks, according to the Trump Ocean Club's bondholder prospectus that was out, Donald Trump was projected to make $74.2 million from the project by the end of 2010. And the disclosure forms that Trump filed with the Office of Government Ethics show that he actually continues to earn management fees and royalties from the Trump Ocean Club. And in the last 3 years, the documents show he was paid as much as $13.9 million. And you know who helped sell those units? Alexander Ventura Nogueira. Don't know who he is. Don't know the guy. Well, the 70-floor waterfront building, which includes apartments and a casino, is facing quite the battle here, and we're going to follow that. And evidently, Marriott is one of the companies that they're entertaining, obviously, to come in and take that over. So we're going to continue to follow that. And not only are we following that, but we're following the money here. A record $107 million was raised for Trump's inauguration. Can you believe that? $107 million? So where did it all go? Where did the money go? And this is according to USA Today. And it's been nearly a year here, folks. I think this is the... It's interesting. This is a year into Trump's presidency here. I think to the day. And we're actually looking at a government shutdown that is going to mark his one-year inauguration with a shutdown. Interesting, isn't it? So nearly a year after President Trump's inauguration here, the committee that has raised a record $106.7 million for the event has not disclosed how much surplus money it still has or provided a final accounting of its finances. We must decline comment at this time, says Kristen Solaro, a spokeswoman for the inaugural committee's chairman, Thomas Barak, said this week to USA Today when they were inquiring about the finances. And Barak evidently, and this is B-A-R-R-A-C-K, not to be confused with our good President Barack Obama. This man, Barak, is a California investment manager and longtime Trump friend, and has said consistently that remaining funds would go to charity. He announced plans in September to give $3 million of the remaining funds to nonprofit groups, the American Red Cross, the Salvation Army, which I like, and Samaritan's Purse, to help with hurricane relief efforts, and said the committee planned more contributions that serve America's agenda. And officials with those entities have not commented. But if you didn't know, presidential inaugural committees are private fundraising vehicles that pay for concerts, balls, and other festivities around the swearing in of the president. And while the committee must report names of donors who gave at least $200, election law does not require an accounting of the spending. And there's few restrictions, folks, on how leftover funds are used. But they obviously, they can't treat this as a piggy bank to themselves. And that's one thing that we do know about this money. And Stephanie Grisham, who's a spokeswoman for the First Lady Melania Trump, has said some of the leftover funds went to renovation of the White House and the Naval Observatory, which is where Vice President Pence and his family live, which is good. That's okay. But she referred a question to the inaugural committee about how much was actually spent. So that's interesting, folks. Where did the money go? And don't you think they should be accountable for it? Yes. Interesting. Well, and another story here, folks, that and these just keep coming at us. I mean, sometimes you really have to pick and choose which ones you think you want to talk about. There's so many, and I try to just keep this to a half an hour. And there's so many out there. It's just mind-boggling. But this one I thought was relevant. I wanted to kind of bring everybody up to snuff on it. And again, there's a show link in my show notes to this article. And the title of it is that Republicans just tried to claim that Medicaid caused the opioid epidemic. Yeah, Republicans just tried to claim that. And Republicans here, according to the article, they seem to have found a new culprit to blame for the opioid epidemic, and it's Medicaid. And they had a hearing where this man spoke. His name is Otto Schalk. He's a prosecuting attorney from Indiana. He spoke at this Senate hearing, and he said, every time a hardworking American pays their taxes, they are inadvertently funding drug dealers with a new supply of high-powered opioids that are poisoning our schools and our streets. And that testimony was heard on Wednesday with the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs, which is led by none other than Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin. Well, he held this hearing on the supposed connection between Medicaid and America's drug crisis. And Johnson's thesis here, summed up in this article, was filed in a report that he put out and his team published on Wednesday. The basic thesis is that Medicaid recipients are taking advantage of the free healthcare by selling their pain pills. And the evidence that he claims and he argues is the fact that states that expanded Medicaid have higher overdose rates, and his finding that 1,072 Americans have been charged or convicted of improperly using Medicaid to get pain pills since 2010. And it's interesting to note here, folks, that the U.S. Health and Human Services Department has said that Medicaid and CHIP, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program, added 14.5 million people by the end of 2015. 14.5 million people. So let's see. Out of 14.5 million people, 1,072, you say, Senator, have been convicted of improperly using Medicaid to gain access to pills. I agree, that's not good. It's never good. But in reality, that's a very low percentage. And when you look at Ron Johnson's report in detail, that number of 1,072 melts even further. And when you look at his report, it melts even further by saying at least 1,072 people have been convicted or charged nationwide since 2010 for improperly using Medicaid to obtain prescription opioids, some of which were then resold on the nation's streets. The number of criminal defendants increased 18% in the 4 years after Medicaid expanded between 2014 and 17 compared to the 4 years prior to the Medicaid expansion. And he says that the criminal activities range from beneficiaries simply selling opioids they obtained through Medicaid to more attenuated healthcare fraud involving Medicaid reimbursement. Oh, okay. So that number also includes, 1,072 also includes healthcare fraud involving Medicaid reimbursement, which means that the real number of people selling pills is even far less than 1,072. It's just crazy. And, I mean, the thing is, the argument, according to this article here, doesn't stand up to scrutiny. It's true that overdose rates are higher in the 31 states that expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, and it's true that opioid abuse is more common among poor Americans. But Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act took place in 2014, nearly 20 years after the overdose rate started creeping up in the first place. And when you further consider the fact that today's opioid epidemic is fueled by illicit fentanyl and heroin, which kill far more Americans than prescription opioids, which is what we're talking about with Medicaid. The problem is fentanyl and heroin. And I don't know. It's just sad to see them come out and somehow in this twisted, half-cocked argument, Republicans are trying to say that by helping Americans, and we're talking poor Americans, by helping them gain health care through Medicaid, you're actually hurting them. You're hurting them by disincentivizing them from work, and then they're making money by selling the drugs that we give them. And folks, we can literally see that with the sunlight of the facts, when we put the facts in the sunlight, their argument is dangerously wrong. It's wrong because expanding Medicaid has had a huge impact on the vast majority of that 14.5 million that have joined it and has saved countless lives in the process. And thank you to President Obama for doing this. Saving lives in the process. It's something that we obviously should be building on, but they seem intent on tearing it down, don't they? Every time we turn around, and this is just the latest attack. This is how they make themselves feel good, by denying health care that actually saves lives, folks. It's sick. It takes a sick and twisted mind, but by convincing themselves that they're hurting the poor by giving them health care, they can look themselves in the mirror every day and feel that they're doing something good. And of course, folks, under this administration, they feel empowered to do so. That's what we're fighting here, folks. And this kind of stuff comes from every corner of this administration almost on a daily basis. And in the next episode, we're going to attack the premise that work requirements for Medicaid are a good idea. We're going to hit that head on. We're going to attack it. And we're going to attack that work requirement that they're trying to put in place now using a conservative think tank study. A conservative study, if you can imagine that. So you'll want to stay tuned for that. Well, folks, our befuddled president strikes again when he surfaced with a tweet on Wednesday that caused massive confusion, helping befuddle federal Republicans trying to keep the government from shutting down when Trump tweeted that the CHIP extension should not be included in a short-term measure. He threw the whole effort into doubt. The White House later clarified the president's comment, saying that he supports the continuing resolution being proposed in the House. So is it any wonder, folks, the government is facing their first shutdown in history by an administration that controls everything in the government? Is it any wonder? Meanwhile, President Trump, he's not concerned. He's not concerned about this or the DACA kids who are facing deportation by March, since Trump himself ended Obama's executive order on DACA. It was all because of Trump ending this executive order. And he doesn't seem concerned about it, does he? He's so unconcerned that he's leaving today, folks, for Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach. Let them all eat cake, right? Let them all eat cake. Well, folks, you do remember Stormy Daniels. My gosh, she's been all over the news. Of course, you can't forget. And Stormy Daniels was a stage name for a porn star that was alleged to have had a tryst with Donald Trump shortly after they met in 2006. And we now know, thanks again to the Wall Street Journal, that President Donald Trump's lawyer used a private Delaware company to pay a former adult film star $130,000 in return for her agreeing not to publicly discuss any alleged sexual encounter with Mr. Trump. According to the corporate records and people familiar with the matter. So paid $130,000. And the lawyer is Michael Cohen, as we have talked about in previous episodes. He established this company called Essential Consultants LLC October 17th of 2016, just before the 2016 presidential election. And Mr. Cohen, the lawyer who is based in New York, then used a bank account that was linked to the entity to send the payment to the client trust account of a lawyer that was representing the woman, Stephanie Clifford, one of the people familiar with the matter said. So this whole idea of using this Delaware company allowed Mr. Cohen to gain some privacy and some simplicity in paying off the porn star. And we've got even more details from an interview that Stormy has done with In Touch magazine. This is just the gift that keeps on giving, folks. It just keeps on coming. And In Touch magazine has just published a 7-year-old interview with a former porn star, Stormy Daniels, in which she goes into a salacious amount of detail about an alleged extramarital affair with Donald Trump that only last week she claimed never took place, the article says. Stormy Daniels, whose real name is Stephanie Clifford, told the magazine in 2011 that the alleged sexual tryst with Trump began in July of 2006 after she met him at a celebrity golf tournament in Lake Tahoe, Nevada. The meeting and alleged affair came a year after the future president married Melania Trump, his third wife. And have you seen the picture of them, Stephanie Clifford, Stormy Daniels, and Donald Trump at that Tahoe resort? Don't you love that picture? He's wearing that at that celebrity golf tournament. They're both standing there, the picture. The media keeps using it, and he's in his yellow, Trump is in his yellow polo shirt. He looks like the mayor of the Lollipop Guild. That little smile that he's got standing next to Stormy Daniels. Oh, I'm so tired of seeing that picture, that look on his face. Oh, it's hideous. And here's what In Touch is reporting. And I quoted here, it says, "I actually don't even remember why I did it, but I do remember while we were having sex, I was like, please don't try to pay me," Daniels said in the 2011 interview that the magazine only recently resurrected. "And then I remember thinking, but I bet if he did, it would be a lot." God. In the In Touch article, Daniels purportedly told the magazine that she and Trump had several more encounters over the next few years. And I quote, she says, "Whether you're a fan of his or not, which I never really was, you gotta admit he's pretty fascinating." Come on. Not really. Not really, Stormy. And Stormy said in the interview that was published Wednesday, "We had a really good banter. He told me once that I was someone to be reckoned with, beautiful and smart, just like his daughter." Oh, God. Did you just say that you reminded him of his daughter and you just had sex with him? I mean, that's beyond gross. I'm sorry. I can't make that go away, folks. I can't make it go away. I wish I could. But that's not all, folks. That's not all. Mother Jones has learned that Daniels, Stormy Daniels, years earlier talked about having had a consensual sexual relationship with Donald Trump in lurid detail. And folks, according to 2009 emails between political operatives who were there at the time advising Daniels on a possible political campaign, the adult film actor and director claimed that her affair with Trump included an unusual act: spanking him with a copy of Forbes magazine. Spanking him! It's all too much. And no, you just can't make the stuff up. You can't make it up. But did you know this? Did you know that Stormy Daniels appeared in the film The 40-Year-Old Virgin? When the main character, Steve Carell, watches her in the video and then tries dreaming or fantasizing about her. This was all back in 2005. And a year later, the alleged tryst and the spanking occurred. Hurts so good, doesn't it? Good Lord. So, what do you think is a better nickname, folks? Stormy Daniels or Little Miss Red Bottom? I don't know. I think we ought to call her Little Miss Red Bottom from now on. How about that? Well, folks, we're continuing to watch the news as always, and I want to thank you, as always, for tuning in. And yes, there will be more. I can guarantee it. We'll see you next time.